That was too loud.
That was beautiful. My name is John, and I'm an alcoholic. And you know that this is such a tremendous privilege for me to be able to share with you tonight. I'd also like to begin by saying that I'm going to give you just a little about AA Atlanta Roundup trivia that you may or may not know. We had the first Atlanta Roundup. It was at the Radisson that's now torn down and they have condos. And the next year, we didn't have a Roundup because it conflicted with the Southeastern here in Atlanta. And from that period on, it took place every year since then. That's a little bit of trivia Roundup that you may or may not know. Now you can take that home with you. I'd like to thank the committee for asking me. They've treated me royally since I've been here. And what I'd like to do is, you've heard a lot about me being the driver for my dear wife, who just recently in June, her AA birthday, by the way, is AA's birthday. It was June the 10th, and she was 31 years sober. My doll, please stand up. I would like to make some things clear so that we can get off on the right foot. My sobriety date is April the 9th of 1959. I was 24 years old when I got sober. Any of you that are a little slow in math, that makes me 74 years old. And I have the good fortune to be Mary Emma's driver back to Hilton Head. But you know, I came here tonight to share a little bit about my life in AA, because as you can tell by the mathematics, that I've spent a lot more time sober than I spent drunk. And I am eternally grateful for that. You know that this afternoon, I spoke a little bit in the relationships meeting, and I want you to know that I got into things this afternoon in that relationships meeting that God took me into, because it was not my words, it was God's word. I hope that He will stay with me tonight so that maybe I can share with you some of the things in my life that I've been hesitant to share before. I'm going to try to do the best I can tonight. I grew up in an Irish Catholic family in northeastern Pennsylvania in a coal mining town called Scranton. The only way I can describe Scranton is a nice place to be away from. And I grew up in a family that was the most functional family that you could imagine. You know, I'm not one of these people who gets up here and tells you that their family was dysfunctional. It was not. Because there was a tremendous amount of love in our family, and I had great parents, no divorce, four boys, and we cared and loved for each other a great deal, with a few exceptions here and there. And I'll get into that in a little bit. My father and mother were the leaders of the family, and they loved each other dearly, and they expressed it all the time. So I had good examples about what a wholesome family should be. And I was taught good values by example, not just by words, by example. And somebody said to me one day, they said, "Are there any other alcoholics in your family?" I said, "Not that I know of." They said, "If you grew up in such a functional family, how did you turn out to be an alcoholic?" I said, "Well, I think you have to drink." And if you ran into any of my brothers and said, I met John in AA, they would say, yes, that's where he belongs. So one of the things that I want you to know is that the place that I started from was a very good place that anybody would like to start from. And you know, I had this father of mine who I worshiped. Now, my mom and I had conflicts growing up. Some of you who were here this afternoon heard me say some of those. But my dad, for some reason or other, and I think it was intuitive with him, he realized that even as a young boy, that I needed some extra help along the way. And I had a relationship with my father that I never had to question. I knew exactly where I stood with my dad my entire life. And I think that I at times have really thanked God that he gave me and my mother gave me the kind of start that they did, because it is my opinion that it helped me get into Alcoholics Anonymous at a young age. And the reason it did is because when I lived my life contrary to the way that I was raised, I had a lot of guilt and a lot of remorse. And I had it in heavy doses. You know, I grew up in this town. I was a pretty bright kid when I was in elementary school. And I reached the age of 15, and I had my first drink of booze. That was my first spiritual experience in my life. Because it was absolutely mind-boggling what it did to me. It changed me entirely. And I got drunk, and I blacked out, and I got sick, and I couldn't wait to do it again. And you know, if you took a look at my life at that period of time, you would have said, you know, that this was a pretty good kid up until now. And I'll tell you how my father explained this to me. My mother was the first one to die, but I came back many years after I got sober, and I was sitting at the kitchen table where all the business was done in our house. And I said to my dad, I said, Dad, did you and Mom know when I started drinking? Oh, yes, he said. I said, well, did you ever think that maybe you might try to do something about it? He said, with you? And I said, how did you know when it happened? He said, hold on a minute. He went upstairs in the closet, got a shoebox, and he came down, he dumped it out on the kitchen table. And they were all my report cards ever since I was in kindergarten. He laid them out on the table. He said, right there. And he was absolutely right. And you know, here's this bright kid in school, takes his first drink, and the grades went just like this, down just like this. And I barely got out of high school, barely got out. I went to a college prep high school, and I was known as the drunk in the school. And you know something? I even then knew that I drank different than many of my fellows. I knew that at that time. And you know, it came time for graduation. And here's this big group of kids that I went to school with getting ready to go off to college in the Northeast, many to Ivy League schools. And I was trying to figure out how I was going to go to work in a factory for $35 a week. And I decided that I needed to do something different than that. And this is once again this alcoholic mind of this young, budding alcoholic. And I decided that what I was going to do is I was going to go into service. Because I thought that was a great idea. Many of you know I live in Hilton Head, South Carolina. And my first visit to South Carolina, was not to Hilton Head. It was to a place called Parris Island, South Carolina. And as a young kid enlisted in the Marine Corps, I got off the train in Yamasee, and they took me over to Parris Island. The year was 1952. It was not exactly great timing to go into the Marine Corps. They had a thing which they referred to as a police action that was going on, and I was going to get some experience in that shortly. So I went to Parris Island. I got there that first night, and I realized I'd made a horrible mistake. But it was an odd thing that took place. And Lyle, God bless him, he summed it up exactly right on Friday night, because he went there too. And that was that of all the things that were going on in my life, I took to the Marine Corps, and I took to it very well. Somehow or another, I took to the discipline, and I took to the order. I took to it very well. And I managed Lyle to graduate from boot camp as a private first class. Well, you know, maybe you people don't think that's a big deal. Lyle knows it's a big deal, and I know it's a big deal. Because that platoon that started out with 78 people ended up with 51. There were a lot of people that were washed out in that beginning of that 13 weeks. It was like the first thing I really completed. And one of the things that they did for me was that I found out that I could fire a rifle quite well. The Marine Corps found out that I could fire a rifle quite well. So they decided what they were going to do with me is they were going to send me to sniper school. I didn't even know what it meant at that time. I found out later what it meant. So what I did is I went on my 10-day leave out of boot camp, and I was going to report to sniper school in Ohio. After leaving there as a full-fledged sniper in the United States Marine Corps, I went to Camp Pendleton. I reported into Camp Pendleton, and I want to tell you that when I arrived there, I flew into Burbank. That's how long ago it was. And I took a bus, got on a bus, and took the bus down to Camp Pendleton. First place he stopped was in Santa Ana. Then there was a big long prairie after El Toro Marine Base. We wound down into a place called San Juan Capistrano. As a kid, I read all about the swallows returning to San Juan Capistrano. And it was beautiful. And then we went down a little further and broke out. I saw the Pacific Ocean for the first time. Well, you know, if you had grown up in the coal mines in Pennsylvania, and the first time you were allowed out, you went to Parris Island, South Carolina. They were not exactly garden spots of the world. And when I got to look at that Pacific Ocean, I thought to myself, this is absolutely gorgeous. So what I did is I reported into my duty at Camp Pendleton. And the first time that I was allowed off the base, I went down to the beach. And they were playing volleyball on the beach. Well, they were not only guys playing volleyball on the beach, there was girls playing volleyball on the beach. And the first thing I thought, I need to learn how to play volleyball. Because that was a great attraction for me. But it wasn't long after that when I got shipped overseas. And I reported into the 1st Marine Division and got assigned to my battalion. And I became a line grunt in Korea. I spent about 6.5 months there, and I got hurt quite badly. And ended up in the being hauled out of there onto the USS Constellation, which was a hospital ship. Ended up in Yokosuka Navy Hospital and was there for a while. And the surgeon who was a captain in the Navy came to me and he said, son, he said, you have a choice. I was not accustomed to that kind of language in the Marine Corps. And by that time, I had become a corporal. And he said, son, you have a choice. You can either stay here in Japan or you can go back to the United States. And he said, by the way, have you been out on liberty yet? And I said, no, sir, I haven't. He said, well, we're going to take care of that. And he gave me a 72-hour pass and a whole pocket full of money. So I went out on liberty, and I came back after the 72 hours, and I said to the captain of the Navy, I'd sure like to stay in Japan. And if you're a 19-year-old young Marine in Japan with all those friendly ladies, I thought this was the place that I was going to stay. So he said to me, what would you, when I told him I'd like to stay, he said, what would you like to do? That's another thing I was never asked in the Marine Corps, is what I would like to do. He said, well, he said, I can get you assigned wherever you want. I said, well, what do they have to offer? And he had a list there. It was like an employment agency. He had a list, and he said, there's an opening in a weapons company, and I kind of cleared my throat. I know about weapons companies. I said, what else do you have? He said, well, we need a staff car driver for a high-ranking officer. I said, you got just the man. So I reported in, and I became Major Lepretti's staff car driver. And I could go into all kinds of details about all the fiascos we were in, but I want to tell you something about it. He was an enlisted man in the Second World War, and he was a Navy Cross winner. Lyle, where are you? You know what that means. And he carried high respect every place he went. Well, eventually I became Sergeant Holmes, and I became the staff car driver for Major Lepretti. And he was married to an ambassador's daughter, and he had a lot of money. And he was very free with spending that money. And to describe our time there, and I could go into all kinds of stories, but to describe our time, that staff car would be leaving the base on Friday night. Sergeant Holmes would be driving. Major would be sitting in the back. Sunday night, that staff car would come back to the base. Major Lepretti would be driving. And Sergeant Holmes would be passed out in the back. And why the hell he put up with that, I don't have the slightest idea. But it finally came time for me to come back home. And I want you to understand something. My tour in the Marine Corps, I look back on proudly. I really do. The Marine Corps was very good to me. And I think that I was as good as I could be to the Marine Corps. But you know, they didn't make a big deal about you being a drunk. As a matter of fact, I always felt at times they kind of encouraged that a little bit. So the time for me to come back to the United States. Once again, I want to tell you about that alcoholic thinking. Because I drank a lot of booze when I was in Japan. And a lot of people didn't frown on the drunk that I was. When I was on that ship coming back to the United States, and I was on it for 33 days, we came back into San Diego because the 1st Marine Division was coming back home. And here's the thought that went through my head. You talk about defective equipment. I thought that what I was going to do is I was going to come back, I was going to get out of the Marine Corps, and I was going to live in Southern California. I was going to make my fortune there. But what I needed to do is I felt as if I needed to get married. Good God Almighty. Where the hell did you come up with that? So I set about the task of finding some poor soul to marry. And you know, if you spend a lot of time drunk trying to find a wife, sometimes you find takers out there even though you're a drunk. And I want you to know, I was going to take that young lady to places that she had never intended on going to. And we got married just before I got out of the Marine Corps. And we went to Los Angeles to live with her mother for me to go to work. And I was one of those guys who was drank every night, drank every day, would drink all day if I could. So I hunted around for a job. I had to find something to do. And you know, as God would have it, what I did is I got a job working for the Los Angeles Times. And it was a wonderful job. And it had a wonderful career. And you know, here I was, this young Marine working in this newspaper. And I had the good fortune of working with Otis Chandler, who was the son of the owner of the paper. And you know, my star was already headed this way, except they didn't know what they had on their hands. And I wasn't in that job a year, and that first child was born. And I was in a horrendous automobile accident in San Diego with a female who was other than my wife in the car. And what they should have done is they should have had the police arrest me, because that car was not supposed to be in San Diego. My territory was in Los Angeles. And the only thing they did to me was they said I couldn't drive company cars anymore. So what I did is I had to get my own car in order to keep my job there, which I did. And you know, I was headed down a very steep hill. And I want you to know something else about this guy. I know we talk a lot about spending time in the service and not people coming back from Iraq, people coming back from Afghanistan, and having problems. A lot of it's psychological problems. I had a lot of those same kind of problems. But you know how I dealt with those problems? I drank them away. And one of the things that you never knew what you had on your hands, and that terrified wife and those terrified kids, is they never knew what was coming through the door. Because I was a very violent person. And you know, I used to accuse that ex-wife of mine of turning those kids against me. She didn't turn those kids against me. Those kids were terrified of their father. That little girl that just visited with us down in Hilton Head, she used to crawl behind the sofa when her dad came home, because she was terrified of me, with good reason. And I was so totally self-centered. All I cared about was me. I didn't have any room for anybody else. And all the warning signs were there. You know, my life was falling apart. I couldn't stay sober. You know, I could report to the newspaper and then go out and drink all day. And then try to make it home out to La Puente. I lived in a suburban skid row out there in La Puente that the in-laws bought the house. They were paying all the bills. But I never paid for anything. And I didn't care. And I want to give you a little idea. This is 2 years before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. We had one of those meetings on Saturday morning. Any of you ever had those meetings, the family get together? Jeez. And the subject was you and your drinking. I remember my mother-in-law and her boyfriend came, and they were doing their preaching. I thought it went on for about 2 hours. I think it maybe was 15 minutes. But it seemed like 2 hours. And they were telling me this. They said, you know, if you continue, John, you're going to lose this family. And you're going to lose your health. And you're going to lose everything in your life. And I was kind of hoping that they brought something to drink. And I couldn't wait until they stopped. And finally, I got up from the table, and I was really sick and very badly hungover. And I said, I'll tell you what you people can do. You people can kiss my ass. Because what I'm going to do is I'm going to live my life exactly the way I want to. And that's what you had on your hands. And you know, that was 2 years before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. You know what? Everything they talked about that morning, every single thing they talked about happened in this next 2 years. I think if there's anything pathetic about the alcoholic, is watch the alcoholic who can't drink continually try to drink. And that was me. There was a time in my life when I could carry a ton of booze and still navigate, sometimes in a blackout, but I could still navigate. And I got to the point where it didn't take hardly anything for me to get knee-walking drunk. And that's a great puzzle to me. Where did that ability to carry that big load of booze, where did that ability go that I used to be able to operate in a blackout and not get picked up by the police sometimes? It all disappeared. And it seemed like it was only a short period of time. And you know, these people at this newspaper, folks, I got to tell you, a lot of drunks work in newspapers. You really have to work hard to get fired in a newspaper. Bill probably knows that. But I managed to do that. And these people really wanted me to succeed. But what happened was, it finally became too much. And the guy that fired me really cared about me a lot, who was non-alcoholic. And he said, John, I'm really sorry that we have to do this. He said, not only are we going to fire you, but we don't want you back on this property. And they told the security guards, he's done. So here I am, sick, hungover, got that check in my pocket, and I'm headed back to that little Skid Row house in La Puente, and I drive in up my street, and I saw a moving van up there. And it was in my driveway. And you know, it was typical that all this family furnishings from the alcoholic's house. You know what it looks like? You know what it looks like. There's wicker furniture, rattan furniture, one of those old tables with chrome tables with chairs, and they're loading all that junk on this little moving van. And here's this terrified gal with these two little kids. And she said, I'm going back home to mother. And I thought to myself, good riddance. Now I can drink the way I want to. I don't know how that was going to be new. But, you know, I didn't have any place to go, and I thought, you know, what I'm going to do, as soon as they get out of here, I'm going to move into that house. And I don't need a bed or anything. It has carpet in it. And by dim, they weren't gone two blocks, and they started boarding up the house. And I said, what are you doing that? They said, you haven't been paying for it. So what we're going to do is we're going to board up the house. And I thought, well, that's not very friendly. So, you know, many times what happens today, you know, when somebody needs a place to live, they go live with somebody else. Not this guy. I didn't have anybody else to live with. Because, you see, with me, I didn't have any friends. Because if you allowed me to get too close to you, I would take whatever you had. Because that's the way I thought. So therefore, I didn't have any friends to go live with. Most of them I owed money to, or possessions, or what else. So I decided I was going to take up housekeeping in this little car that I had, which I'll tell you about in a few minutes. And I'm driving around trying to find a place to keep the sheriff's department from arresting me, because you know, you just can't park in a shopping lot or any place like that, you know, they frown on that. So I saw this little lot right next to this orange grove. It was off the paved road. And I thought to myself, you know what? That looks like a good spot. So I pulled my little Renault Dauphine off the road into that little spot. And I thought, you know, if I just position myself properly in this car, I can sleep here. And the reason that I slept there is because I had a couple of other guys who were living in that car with me, and their names were Ernest and Julio Gallo. So the three of us took up housekeeping in that Renault Dauphine. And I'd like to tell you today that I knew exactly how long I stayed living in that car in that orange grove. And I don't know. You know why I don't know? Because I would come to and I would see the sun and I didn't know if it was coming up or going down. The only time I could discern maybe about what time it might be is if it was dark outside. It must be sometime during the night. And I stayed there as long as I could stay there. And one morning, I got up, staggered out, fell out the door. And I'm on my knees, and I was throwing up blood. But I've been doing that for a long time. That was nothing new. And I was in a place that I hope to God that I never, ever have to go to again. And it's the place called despair. That place of despair for me, there was no lower spot for me to be in. See, I had tried every possible way that I could do to stop drinking, and I could not. I couldn't even get 24 hours together. And I had great resolve in a lot of things in my life, but when it came to alcohol, I had absolutely no power. And I want you to understand something else. I knew what my problem was. I know a lot of people come to AA and they say, you know, they're not really sure what their problem. I knew what mine was. My problem was booze. Because for me, booze was problems. So one of the things that I did is after I finished throwing up blood, in this moment of despair, I turned to the only place that I could turn to. And this was my plea on that morning. Please, God, help me. Please, God, help me. You know, I had one of those tapes going on in my head. I'm sure some of you remember. It just goes round and round. It's the same shit goes round and round and round and round in your head. When I said this prayer, it stopped. Little message about that long. And the message was, call Alcoholics Anonymous. I never read anything about AA. I never heard anything about AA. There was nothing on television about AA. Nobody ever talked to me about AA. But I was in such a terrible strait that I just followed directions, probably for the first time in a long time. I started up that little car and I drove in towards Los Angeles. I went to a drugstore. I went back and used a payphone. Remember now, folks, this is a long time ago. You had to put money in the phone. And I called information. You know what usually happens when you call information? They give you the number, you try to figure out how to write it down someplace. She didn't do that. I said, I'd like to have the number of Alcoholics Anonymous. She said, just a minute, please. Plug me into Alcoholics Anonymous. A lady answered the phone. Her name was Sybil. And she didn't talk to me for 5 minutes. And she knew exactly what my problem was. She said, There's a place on Southwestern Avenue called the Southwest Delano Club. This is in L.A. And she said, if you can make your way there, she said, there'll be somebody there to talk to you. And I said, that's fine. I said, I can get there. I have a car. When I got to the address on Southwestern Avenue, I saw the most amazing thing. I looked at this storefront. It was right in the middle of the territory I had been fired from the Los Angeles Times. I've been by that place hundreds of times on Southwestern Avenue. I'm certainly glad it was there the day that I needed it. And I went up to the front door, and I went to open the door, and somebody from the inside opened the door. It was a little guy, kind of stringy hair, and he had hexagon glasses. And he's standing there, old enough to be my grandfather. And he stuck out his hand and he said, my name is Joe. He said, what's yours? See, I don't remember any of this. He repeats this to me. He said, you asked me two questions. How do I become a member? And how much are the dues? And he said, kiddo, if you step across the threshold, he said, you can become a member. And he said, as far as the dues are concerned, it's apparent that you've already paid yours. That was my introduction to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had no idea. I had absolutely no idea where this journey was going to take me. And you know, I was sick, and I went in, and they were going to have a meeting. And this place was not exactly Fifth Avenue. I mean, it was a pretty raunchy place. And they had these stale donuts, and the coffee did taste putrid. They had these big cups, and they only put just a little bit in the cup, and there was a good reason for that. And I tried to eat the donuts and tried to drink their crappy coffee, and all I do is just puke all the time. But they let me stay there, and they said, we're going to have this meeting, and they read a whole bunch of stuff. I don't remember I couldn't comprehend anything. And after the meeting, some people talked to me, and I was trying to explain to them about all the woes that I had in my life. And they said, you just keep coming back, son, and you're going to be all right. And I thought, why the hell are they not listening to me? But after they were going to get rid of me that afternoon, so they had a bunch of pamphlets. In those days, they did not have many pamphlets, but they gave me all they had. Because you see, what I was going to do is I was going to drive back out to that street light where that orange grove was, and I was going to read those pamphlets. And as I started to go through the pamphlets, they even gave me a one to the alcoholic woman. I guess they figured it wouldn't hurt, you know? So what I did is I started to read in these pamphlets about what was going on in my life. And I want you to understand, nothing made very much sense. So next morning, as soon as I tried to eat a little something the next morning, which was a catastrophe, and I got into that little Renault Dolphine, and I drove back to the Southwest Delano Club in Los Angeles. You see, I thought that was AA there. I didn't know that they had meetings other places. I thought that was AA, so I must go back there for the AA. So I drove back there the next day, and the guy who talked to me, Joe Motes, is long dead. He's dead years ago. He said, I'm going to be your temporary sponsor. And he had an old Chevrolet. And in this old Chevrolet, what would happen is the newcomer had the seat in the back on the middle of the hump. And as the month progressed, what you would do is you'd move up to the next best seat. until you finally made your way all the way up to the front seat and the door, and then you're out the door. And in Los Angeles in those days, which I just love to tell this story, when they had, in the meetings, they had newcomers row, which was a row of chairs against the wall. And all the newcomers sat over there. And this is what they told you. They said, "Do we have any newcomers?" They didn't want your name. They didn't want to hear another single word from you. And sometimes today, I think that's not such a bad idea. And what I did is I was there after 30 days, and this is what Joe Moats said to me. He said to me, "I'm going to introduce you to your sponsor." Now, he didn't say to me, "Listen, I want you to see if you can find somebody you can communicate with." He said, "This fellow over here is going to be your sponsor." I said, "Okay." He said, "His name is Howard. Everybody calls him Howdy." "Okay, Howdy. Howdy, Howdy." So I got introduced to him, and he said, "Where do you live?" Well, I had been sober for 30 days, and I certainly wasn't going to tell him I was still living in my car, but I had no choice. He asked me again. I said, "Well, I'm staying in the car." And he said, "I don't think so." He said, "I think you're going to come home with me. I'll put you in my basement." Could you imagine that? He didn't know me. He just met me. And he was going to take me home and give me a place to stay. I want to tell you, before I go on, about that 1957 Renault Dauphine. There's probably a few people here old enough to remember what a 1957 Renault Dauphine looked like. They were kind of a boxy little car. The engine was in the back, but they were pretty square, you know, pretty square little French car. Now they call them Renaults. But I had the only round Renault Dauphine. And the way it gets to be that way, if you smash in all four corners, it'll come down the street kind of sideways like this at you. And it had a huge puke streak on the inside of the back window. And if you're on the freeway and throw up on the freeway, you know how it gets on the inside of your back window. And that's what I arrived into Alcoholics Anonymous with. You know, I went to live in this basement, and I'll tell you what I did. I took care of his pool and cleaned his pool, and I landscaped his yard. You know, if you're 24 years old and you're 30 days sober, you begin to look good. You know, you come back pretty quickly. And I was getting quite a tan, and that pool, I spent a lot of time in that pool, and I had his yard looking real good. And we go to meetings. Somebody asked me one time, they said, "Did you do 90 meetings in 90 days? I said, "I never heard of it. We just went to a meeting every night. Nothing else to do." And he was my first sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous, and he was a wonderful guy. And I was there for a while, and he asked me a terrible thing to do. I was just shocked by this. He said to me he wanted me to go down to the Los Angeles Times and make amends to them. What? "Yeah, we want you to go down and make amends to them." Well, that was not exactly on my... But I was staying in his house eating his food. So I figured, well, okay. So I was going to go back down there. So what I did is I went back down very hesitantly and reported into my old boss, non-alcoholic by the name of Paul Mahoney. I will never forget his name. And I went up and I told Paul, I liked him very much, and he liked me too. He didn't like what I had become, but he liked me too. And I said to Paul, I told him exactly what my sponsor told me to say to him and making an amend. He said, John, he said, I'm really happy that you're doing something about your life. And I thought, geez, that's got that over with. He said, by the way, he said, how would you like your old job back? I thought, geez, that's not what I came there for. I came there to make amends. This was beyond my comprehension. And he said, don't think we're trying to do you any favors. He said, you had that territory screwed up. Nobody could make a living on it. But he said, would you like your job back? And I said, yes, I'd like my job back. So what he did is he made arrangements for me to come right back to work. And that was my entrance back in sober. I had been sober 60 days. And it was the beginning of a journey for me. Now, as far as the first three steps are concerned, under the tutelage of my first sponsor, I took the first three steps. And if you were to ask me, did you do that completely? I would say to you that I did that because my sponsor, who I lived in his basement, said to me that we're going to do the first three steps. And I thought it would be a good idea if I said, yes, we'll do the first three steps. And I did them to the best of my ability, the first three steps. And I felt pretty good about it. And I hadn't done anything else because when I looked at that step four, as far as writing an inventory, don't talk to me about that one. That seemed like an impossibility to me. So one of the things that happened is after I got my job back at Los Angeles Times, and I'm still driving the Renault Delphine, I tried to clean it up a little bit. Never could get that wine taste out of, smell out of that car. It just kind of lingered there. And I had now started to get some health back, and I want you to know something else. I went to work every day, and I worked hard every day, and it's just amazing what happens when you go to work. You know, it shows up in the paycheck. And finally, my sponsor said to me, he said, I think it's time for you to find another place to live. So what I did is I went and found another member of Alcoholics Anonymous, a guy by the name of John Keefe, and he and I shared a garage apartment together. I could write a book about that year that we spent together. But now I had been sober 6 months. And I want you to understand something else, folks. In Southern California, they had no chips. You didn't get any kind of recognition until you were sober for a year. In Southern California, they gave you cakes. And put, you know, some of them had five candles, 5 years. God, I thought that was an eternity. But, you know, I was coming up on a year of sobriety. And all I could think about was maybe I could find a car dealer that I could make a deal with on this Renault Delphine and get rid of it. And I found some poor soul who was willing to take it in a trade. He had a car sitting on his lot that I had my eye on. And it was a 1957 Triumph TR3. And I'll tell you what, folks, when we finally signed the papers, I thought I had died and gone to heaven. You know, it had three tops. It had a hard top, it had a soft top, and it had a tonneau cover. I just took that soft top, put it down, never put it back up. And the hard top, I just put that away in the garage. And I drove all the time with just a tonneau cover. And I thought that was the coolest thing in the world. And I can remember this like it was yesterday. They were building the freeway system in Los Angeles in those days. And I was coming in San Bernardino Freeway, which they now call a number. And I'm not familiar with all the numbers. All I knew that was the San Bernardino Freeway eventually. And I got to coming in to El Monte, and you cross the San Gabriel River. And you know, everybody's driving along this freeway at 70 miles an hour. I look over at the car on my left, and he's looking over at me. And I looked over on my right, and the guy on my right is looking at me, and I couldn't figure out what it was. I had the radio on, and I was singing at the top of my voice. And thank God that you folks don't have to hear me sing. But you know what that was? That was the joy of sobriety. That's exactly what it was. That was a guy who was really grateful for being sober. I have to stop here for a minute and tell you something. I was almost a year sober when all this took place. And to tell you how sick I was, God, in His infinite grace, had removed the obsession to drink shortly after I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that obsession had never returned. And you see, I didn't even realize it at that time. I thought it maybe was the people in the program or my sponsor or maybe the literature or maybe something else. I never gave God credit for that. And it was only on looking back that I could see where that came from. That was my first glimpse into God working in my life. And what I started to do is I started to work real hard in Alcoholics Anonymous in order to try to repair things. I was even paying child support. You know, today I talked to a lot of guys that I sponsored today. And that's one of the things we talk about. And you know, I hear from some of the guys I sponsored the same thing that I told my sponsor. I said, if I pay child support, I'm not going to have anything left. He said, tough shit. And I can tell you today, with grown kids and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, that I can face those kids today, and I can tell you that it was the program of Alcoholics Anonymous who made me realize what my responsibility was to those innocent bystanders in that divorce. And that's the journey that I started on. I worked for this newspaper for the next... Wow. I worked for this newspaper for the next 5 years in my sobriety. And I did very well working for this newspaper, sober. My career was outstanding. And the Los Angeles Times became the Times Mirror Corporation, and it changed overnight. It was previously owned by the Chandler family. And all of a sudden, the family disappeared, and the corporation took over. And it was never the same for me again. And I knew that I was going to have to leave. I was going to have to leave that newspaper, who had been so very good to me, because it wasn't the same newspaper. And I didn't know what I was going to do, and I had a friend of mine who was non-alcoholic, who was kind of my business mentor, who helped me get my next job. And it was the kind of job that alcoholics dream about. You see, I went to work for a company that was in Wisconsin, and I was in Southern California, and I became a regional sales manager for this company. And this is what they insisted on. My territory was the 11 western states and Hawaii. I'm a single, and I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm sober 5 years. And they insisted that I fly first class on the airlines. Never been in first class. They insisted if you go to a hotel, you stay in a suite, not a room. I thought, God, why, this is wonderful. Paid all your expenses. And you know what I did? I traveled the whole area. And I went to AA meetings all over the place. All of those 12 states and Hawaii. And I was living large. Never had so much fun in all my life. I used to hear people complaining about traveling, and I thought, God, what are you complaining about? They pay for your travel and pay for your meals. I thought that was wonderful. And you know, I did that for 2 years, and it paid me a lot of money, a great deal of money for that period of time. And after 2 years, the people in this company that was in Wisconsin said they were coming out to play golf out in Palm Springs, and I played golf in those days, and they said, we want you to come out because we want to talk to you about something, John. I said, well, okay. I thought, well, God, they're catching up with me. So I went out to Palm Springs, and we played golf, and that evening they all got drunk, which they always did. And they asked me if I'd drive. I became a designated driver before it was even the name was even coined. So I drove and came back to the house, and they said, we want to talk to you about something. And I thought, whoops, the other shoe's going to drop. They said, we have just fired our vice president of sales nationally in this company, and we'd like you to consider taking that job. Phew, could knock me over with a feather. He said, but it's going to require moving from Southern California to Wisconsin. Well, I'm going to have to think that one over. And I tried to renege. But what they kept doing is they kept increasing the ante. Until I got to a place, they made me an offer I couldn't refuse. Now, I want to tell you, this is, once again, you're talking about a guy that's 7 years sober. 7 years. And I want to instill this in everybody here tonight. Sanity does not necessarily follow sobriety. Because what happened was, once again, this defective equipment up here, after taking the first 5 steps in this program, somebody said to me, what kind of a fourth step did you write the first term around? You know, they talk about fearless and thorough. I said, kind of fearful and inadequate. But I had some good counsel on my fifth step, which I can't go into tonight because of time. But what I thought in this defective piece of equipment was, if you're going back to Wisconsin and you're going to be in this corporate structure, what you need to do is you need to have a ready-made family, because you don't have one, and take it back there and be the corporate vice president. So I have been dating a gal in the program who was almost sober. And gathered up that family, got married, and moved to Wisconsin. And here in my mind, I'm saying happily ever after, you know. Big house, company cars, plenty of money. Good God, I can't tell you how bad that was. We weren't there 30 days, and she was off drunk. In the president's bar. And I thought, whoops. Once again, insanity rears its ugly head. You know, my business career skyrocketed. My personal life went into the dumper. Because you see, what I was on, I was on my quest for money, property, and prestige. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be somebody. Well, I became somebody. Somebody who was a visitor to AA. I didn't take a drink, but I was crazy as hell. And you know, this 5-year period that we were in Wisconsin, it was just catastrophe. And these kids were going crazy. And this poor wife was, you know, between the pills and the booze, it was crazy. We decided that we were going to go on a geographic to Atlanta. There's only a few people in here who remember that. I moved to Atlanta in 1971 to start a business. And started a business with another fella by the name of Sam. And we started this business and worked really hard at it. Things weren't getting any better at home, but we worked hard at it. And it became quite a successful business. Had a plant out there in Norcross, and we were doing very well. After 7 years in business, it was now 1978. We finally, that second wife of mine and I finally decided we were just going to give up the ship and we were going to get divorced. And you know, she was also trying to stay sober in AA, so we became an AA divorce. I highly recommend that you don't get a divorce in AA. Because you know, we talk about the loving, kind, generous people in Alcoholics Anonymous. Take sides. I was on one side, they were on the other. And it was not fun. It was not fun. And a lot of hurt people along the way. And I'm trying to get reinvolved in AA. And you know what? I was one of those people who always wanted to be up on the stage. And I always wanted to have people think well of me. And it was very important about what you thought about me. That's the way I lived my life. So in order for you to think well of me, what I needed to do is I needed to be up. Anything that was going on, like the Atlanta Roundup, I wanted to be the voice, or I wanted to be on the committee, or, you know, somebody up front. And a strange thing took place in 1978, during the period of this divorce. I was in New York City. And we had offices at 295 Fifth Avenue. We had showrooms there. And I was going to wander out of the Essex House, and I was going to go down to the meeting downtown called the Midtown Meeting. And what I was going to do is I was going to go down there. They had two meetings. They had an early meeting for the street people. Then they had a later meeting for the elites, and I was waiting for the elites meeting. But I got there a little early, and the street people were still there. And I shall never forget this all the days of my life. I arrived there at the meeting, and I'm going to just describe to you exactly the way I was dressed. I had that black cashmere top coat on with that black Italian suit with the French cuffs and the Italian leather shoes and the monogram shirts. And I'm standing in the back of the meeting, and I thought, I'm going to take this top coat off, because I was in the church and it was kind of warm. And I thought, you can't take that top coat off. It'll disappear out of here in 10 minutes. And the next thought that came into my mind terrorized me. I was 19 years without a drink. 19 years. And this is the thought that went through my mind. What am I doing here in this meeting with those people? You have no idea how much trouble I was in. And when I finally was able to take that in, I realized where I was. And it terrified me. to the point that I left there immediately and went back to the hotel. Packed my bags and went to the airport, took a cab to the airport and got a plane back to Atlanta. Reported into the company and said, I have to take off for 30 days. And they said, what for? I said, I can't tell you. I said, but I won't be back for a month. But here's the telephone number where you can reach me. And I went back to Southern California to finish that cleanup job that I had started so many years before and never completed it. And I say to you, if you're in the middle of taking your steps in this program, complete the job. Complete the job. Because if you don't, you may find yourself in the back of a meeting wondering what you're doing there. And I spent time with this sponsor in Southern California for this next 30 days. And he said to me, where do you want to start, John? I said, I want to start at step one. And at the end of 30 days, we had completed all the steps in this program. And I knew that something had changed and had changed inside me. Because you know what, folks? It was no longer important what you thought about me. It didn't mean anything. What was only important was what I thought about me. And I knew where I was. And I started working in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had this divorce hanging over my head. And right after returning here, I got a call from my partner who said he was going to be late coming into work because he was going to take off the morning. And at 2 that afternoon, I found out that he had committed suicide in his garage. And you know, it really rocked me. I was going through divorce on one hand, and my partner had just committed suicide on the other. But you know what? I had this program, and I had you people, and I had a God that I understood for the first time in my life. And things were entirely different in my life. As I knew that God didn't carry me this far to let me down now. And I went to work and went through this divorce and stayed active in Alcoholics Anonymous and took care of the business affairs to the best of my ability. And I thought that what was going to happen is after this divorce, I was going to have to spend the rest of my life by myself. I mean, that was my, and I was fine with that. That did not bother me at all. I was not looking for anything, and I was really starting to do some work on myself and to take a look at me and what kind of a person I was. And this afternoon in the relationships meeting was I talked about going outside this program to get some help, to be able to take a look at my life in certain areas. Not all areas, in certain areas. And I'm happy to say to you that I received some very good help. Because what happened to me is I was very happy in Alcoholics Anonymous, living by myself. And that was not God's plan for me. I didn't know that. That was not God's plan for me. And into my life comes this little blonde lady. And you know what? For the first time in my life, I did it right, folks. I courted her with flowers and dates. And she had her own place and I had mine. And it was absolutely, absolutely wonderful. For the first time in my life, I did it right. I was finally growing up in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I finally got to the point where I knew how to treat a lady. And I knew how to recognize a lady when I met one. And it was at the Atlanta Roundup where one year where we had a great coming out. You know, we arrived together and they said, ooh, a couple, you know. 1982, we got married. So that means that we are 27 years married in this program. Eight years ago, we moved from here to a place we bought in Hilton Head Island. Now, I want you to just question yourself, folks, if you can. Just think about this for a moment, if you will. How do you get from the orange grove in La Puente to Hilton Head Island? You can't, except in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. See, anything is possible here. Anything is possible. When I look back on my life, our life, all the things that have happened in my life, all the joys, all the wonderful things, all the pain, all the tragedy, are all part of our recovery. I'm so grateful that I'm an alcoholic, I don't have words to explain it to you. You see, if I was not an alcoholic, I would never have gotten sober in AA, and I would never have been able to meet this young lady here. That was all part of God's plan, and I know that today. You see, I have a lot of people sitting in this audience that know me, and I know them. And they know what I'm like, and I know what they're like. And I've been given the privilege of sharing in their life and have had the ability to watch the light come on in their eyes. That's a tremendous gift. I think Dr. Bob had it right. Trust God, clean house, and help others. You know what? At the end of this journey, I can tell you, this is how I feel about myself. And I want to close by telling you what I think it is. After over 50 years in this program, I have come to the conclusion that I'm just another bozo on the bus. God bless you.